Okay, good evening and welcome once again. This is the finale of our From Frankfurt on Main to Frankfurt on the Hudson. We didn't make it all the way to the Hudson. We didn't even make it all the way to the end of the 18th century. It's such a rich treasure trove of material for those who are interested. Maybe we'll have to have another session of these classes. But in the meantime, we're in the first half of the 18th century, and the rabbinic personality that I'd like to study with you tonight is the personality of Rabbi Jacob Joshua Falk, the author of the Pnei Yeshua, sometimes known just as the Pnei Yeshua. So before I tell you a little bit about him, I just wanted to share with you a couple of comments from people who knew him or knew about him or met him, which give you a sense for just who it is that we're talking about. The 18th century happens to be a century of rabbinic giants. Okay, so it's hard to tease out, you know, who's who and who's the most important and the most influential. We just think about who's in the 18th century. So you have the Chacham Tzvi, and you have the Shvus Yaakov, and you have Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz, and they talked about last week the Shav Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Poppers, and then we didn't talk about the Chassidim, the Besht and his students, and the Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and the Vilna Gaon. I mean, on and on and on. Just extraordinary rabbinic personalities. And I wanted to just share with you very briefly to begin three comments that I hope will give us an inkling for who the Pnei Yeshua was and who he was perceived of as being by his contemporaries and by his successors. So if you have the source sheet in front of you, I'll just pull up a couple of quick snippets to give you a sense of how this man is described. And source number one, so this is a Haskama written to a book which was published after the Pnei Yeshua was already deceased. This is the words of the Noda B'Yehuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau, who himself was arguably one of the most important rabbinic figures of the century, and he refers to the Pnei Yeshua, whose book he's approbating, as Meir Mizrach. Can you see this here? Pnei Yeshua apre ravere shel meor hagola hagaon hamifursam mofes hadur. It is a very unusual and extraordinary expression to call someone the mofes hadur. I don't even know exactly how we would translate it, but the giant of his generation. If you jump to source number three, so this is a this is one of his sons talking, so it's not totally impartial, but in the fourth line of source number three, you could see where it says Mekubal Gadolhu Chaya Hayasar Hatorah Begadol Hador Hagaon Rabban Shel Kol Bnei Hagola. So the cat's meow. No one's bigger. You don't just describe anybody as the Gadol Hador. You describe someone as the Gadol Hador if they are the Gadol Hador. Talking about the Pnei Yeshua, I'll give you one more quick snippet from source number two. This is from a book called Magal Tov from Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai. So who's Reb Yosef Chaim Yosef David Azulai? Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai is better known by his acronym, the Chida, an extraordinary personality. Maybe on another occasion we'll have an opportunity to think about him and learn about him. He was a massive Talmud Chacham and wrote very important Svarim, many of which are in use today on a regular basis in the Beis Medrash. He was also a Shadar, which is to say, he traveled as a representative of the Sephardic community in Palestine in the middle of the 18th century. He traveled through Europe and the Ottoman Empire collecting money from Jewish communities. Because as we've talked about on numerous occasions, the Jews of Palestine couldn't make ends meet. So what makes the Chida special is that he kept a diary, a travel log of every community that he visited. And he's just totally candid and totally honest. I visited such and such community, And they were so nasty to me. They didn't hear me out. They didn't give me a chance to make my pitch. They didn't give me any money. They didn't offer me any hospitality. I got to another community. They were so friendly. They were so welcoming. I met this person. He introduced me to another person. They were so generous. Okay. So if he says something, right, he means it. He doesn't sugarcoat. If he tells you he doesn't like somebody, he tells you he doesn't like somebody. So this is already late in the life of the Pnei Yoshua, a couple of years before the end of his life, 1754, the Chida, it happens to be visiting, I think this is a story from Worms, and he writes the following. It's a fascinating book, by the way. I'll just mention, in the last year or two, there are two new versions of Ma'agal Tov. One is basically a coffee table book, and every location is like a picture or a painting or a photo or something going on. So you visit Worms. So we happen to have a picture of the synagogue from Worms in the 17th or 18th century. So he puts it in there. The fascinating coffee table book, and a fascinating way to learn about 18th century Jewish history, reading the travel diary of the Chida. So he writes the following. He says, Nasanu, he's got the dates, right? This is Gimel Av. Parshas Ekev, 1754. Nasano im ha'gala ha'leches pa'machas b'shavua mi Frankfurt de Main le'Vermiza. Okay, fun fact, I didn't know there was a coach once a week in 1754 that traveled from Frankfurt to Worms. Ubana yom dalid samuch l'mincha. How long did it take to get there? Well, I don't know what time they left, but they left on Tuesday. They got there on Wednesday. V'tekef halachti l'kabal p'nei harav bal p'nei Yoshua haniskar mareu kemare malach elokim. My first stop is I went to see the Pnei Yoshua, and when I saw him, it was like seeing a Malach Elohim. I mean, who gets described as being a Malach of Hashem? Behu b'chasto, he spearly panim, and he welcomed me so nicely, and he invited me in, and he showed me his book, and on and on. So to be described as a Malach Elohim, to be described as the Mofet Hadur, the Gadol Hadur, so it should give you just a sense before we begin, by way of introduction, to say that we're not just talking about, to say nothing of any of the personalities that we've talked about before, some of whom were very prominent and very important, but the Pnei Yoshua is in another stratosphere. We're in another league. So who is it? Who was this man, and what did he do that made him so extraordinary? So Rav Yaakov Yoshua Falk was born in 1680, at the end of 1680, in Krakow. He always signed his name Yaakov Yosha Mikrakow. And he didn't want to write out the first three letters of Hashem's name, so he didn't write. His name was, Yoshua, but he wrote it like in a kind of Yiddishized nickname without the hey, Yud Vav Shin Ayin Yaakov Yosha, and he went by that name. His grandfather was very well known. His grandfather was the author of an important book called the Megine Shlomo. And as a young person, he studied with some of the greats of his generation, including with Reb Gavriel Eskelis, who was reputed to be one of the leading Talmudic figures in Lemberg and beyond. So at about the age of 20 or so, he's married, and he has a young child. And he's living in Lemberg in 1702. And he's the victim of a terrible tragedy. So it's not clear to me, or really to anyone, what precipitated this tragedy. But he writes in the introduction to his book the following story. And I'll read it for you in translation.
Ron.
Source number four. Okay. So let me pull up source number four on the screen. And if you scroll down to the bottom of source four, hopefully you can see all of the English translation of this section. Okay, so what happened in this end of 1702? He says, "Behold, I accepted upon myself." No, I'm sorry, I have the wrong starting point there. Okay, so Yeah. Behold, I accept upon myself an obligation and vowed this vow at the moment of my anguish on the day of Hashem's wrath. 3 Kislev, 5463, in the holy community of Lviv, present day Lviv, Lemberg. I was tranquil in my home and invigorated in my sanctuary together with my friends and students who were listening to my voice when suddenly the city was turned into a heap. Overturned in a moment, though no hands were laid on her. You know, this wasn't a war, but what happened? The sound of a cry was not heard. There wasn't an invasion, but the sound of a blaze was singled out together with the appearance of a great flame that rose through our palace and windows due to some large and frightful kegs filled with gunpowder. Okay, so there was the Great Northern War raging kind of in the nearby regions. So it's not totally unsurprising that there would have been a stockpile of gunpowder not too far away. What triggered it, what ignited it is not known to me, but there was some massive explosion that leveled the city block where he was. Everything went up in smoke due to some large and frightful kegs filled with gunpowder. They were the cause of a fire that destroyed the homes, making them uninhabitable. A number of large and very tall walled homes were lowered to the dust, raised to the very foundation. 36 holy souls of Israel were killed. Among the casualties were also members of my household. My first wife, you can imagine how old she was. The Pinayoshu was 22. Her mother, my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, her mother's father. So the grandfather, the tragedy reached my young daughter, her mother's only child. Okay, so his whole family is wiped out in an instant in Lemberg at the end of 1702. She was beloved to me, foremost in rank. I too was among the fallen of this lofty place into a deep pit. I came to the deepest depths of the ground underneath, just like under a press, because of the heavy burden of the heaps and heaps that fell upon me, pillars of our home more than pillars in a mill. He did not allow me to refresh my spirit. My hands and limbs were not under my control. I was paralyzed. I said, I am doomed. With my days cut short, deprived of the rest of my years, I will not again behold a man with the inhabitants of the earth. He's writing this, this is no modern Hebrew. He's just calling on Psukim and Talmudic references. Therefore, I said, when I was still under the heap, if the Lord be with me and take me out of this place to peace and build for me a faithful house to increase its boundaries with students, then I will not remove myself from the walls of the Beit Midrash, and I will be diligent in the doors of study of topics in Shas and Poskim, and I will lodge in the depths of Halacha, even spending many nights on one issue. And sure enough, he escaped. He was unburied from among the ruins of this terrible calamity. He took this vow. He said, God, if you will help me and allow me to survive, I will respond by committing my life to Torah, and he writes this introduction to the book, which is the outgrowth of the vow that he took years earlier in the course of this tragedy. Now, I'll just mention a couple of quick other points from the introduction to his book, which we'll talk about in a few moments. He writes in the bold sections of source number four. Let me see what happened to my source sheet here. I'm sorry if it disappeared. Hopefully we can retrieve it. Okay, well, you'll take my word for it. In source number four, we'll try to put it back here in a second. But in source number four, the Pnei Yehoshua writes the following. He says, we were always in a state of war. And here you go. It's the bold here. He says, there was like no escaping. Kol rash truas milchama kam v'kama shanim ad shebarov hayamim. Ad shebarov hayamim hayu hasfarim shelanu te'unin geniza yamim rabim lahatzilam mipnei hadeleko shesarfo ha'oivim kam v'kama kilos minispazrim e'il e'ir. So it's hard to envision even what he's describing, but he says that there was such a constant state of war that we had to bury our books. We had to bury our svarim so that they didn't go up in flames, because one community after the next was just being destroyed. We were constantly on the run. And what could we do? There were times in my life where I was just without anything. I didn't have any items, any book, anything at all. And he says, You know, this was just a this is just a constant state of you know, depravity for us on an ongoing basis. He even says, and this is amazing, he says his grandfather's book he had heard about. His grandfather's book was published in 1715, and 25 years later, he says, "I never saw the book." Right, which is just an amazing thing to think about. The book's in publication, it's in circulation. And again, we're going to come to Frankfurt, where he's going to serve at the end of his life. But in these, you know, Polish, Eastern European communities, the state of affairs is not a happy one for the Pnei Yeshua in these early years. He remarries, he remains in Lemberg for a short time, and then we really have a hard time piecing together exactly where he was over the coming years. You know, it's not totally unsurprising that there's no biography of some of the, you know, characters who we've learned about in the first three classes of this series, but there's no biography, like there's no meaningful biography of the Pnei Yeshua. The last thing anyone wrote was a 30-page, you know, pamphlet in the 1930s. And it just doesn't add up. He deserves much more attention, and someone's going to have to do a little research and piece together even just the bare bones of where he was and when he was and what he was doing during this time. What we do know is that he was serving in a number of small communities in Eastern Europe. In 1710, I may have mentioned this in passing last week, a position opened up to become the Ashkenazic chief rabbi in Amsterdam, which is a very prominent, very prestigious community and a very well-paying post. And he applied, but the competition was very steep. Among the competitors was Rav Yaakov Poppers, who went on to become the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, who we talked about last time. And the winner of the competition, Chacham Tzvi, who served in that post for not quite 4 years. The Pnei Yeshua, Rav Yaakov Yosha of Krakow was very young. He was just 30 at the time, and the other competitors were more senior, and he came in last place, which is amazing to think about. But he took these small positions, and finally in 1719, after Chacham Tzvi, who had been for a short time the chief rabbi of Lemberg, after Chacham Tzvi passed away, the Jews of Lemberg appointed the Pnei Yeshua to be their rabbi. So he's jumping around, moving from place to place. We're not exactly or entirely sure why. Some of it might be, you know, literally or figuratively political, and some of it may have been characterological, which is to say, to hold these positions, you need to be able to get along with people, and you need to be able to work with the community. And if somebody's bouncing around from position to position, so you know right away that something is wrong. Lemberg works out for a few years. He's the chief rabbi of Lemberg for just a few years. Lemberg is fascinating for a few reasons. One of which is that to be the chief rabbi of Lemberg, at least in this period, meant that you were the chief rabbi of Lemberg and its environs. And the surrounding communities, this was not an uncommon model in the 18th century. So you're not the rav of a shul, you're the rav of a community, and the rav of a community services, you know, smaller outlying communities that can't necessarily support a rabbi themselves. So somewhere toward the beginning of the 1720s, there's a friction and there's a break, and Pnei Yeshua loses his job in Lemberg, and he becomes the rabbi of the Lemberg environs, you know, something like that. And there's this ongoing tension and there's this ongoing friction. He moves to a town called Buchach, something like that, where he's serving in this you know, position for a number of years. And finally, in around 1731, he's called upon to become the chief rabbi of Berlin, which is obviously a major community and an important promotion. So we actually have, and I think I have a copy of it on your source sheet, but I'll put up a better image. We actually have his rabbinic contract from Berlin. Okay, so fascinating document. What does it tell us about the Pnei Yeshua's role as the chief rabbi of Berlin? And I'll just say one fascinating footnote. which is that when he signed his name during these years, 1730 to 1734, he signed his name as the chief rabbi of Berlin and of the Poland, of the Lemberg environs. Like, he never really left that position. So he was kind of holding both, and there may have been back payment that was still owed to him. It requires more research. I'll just give you a couple quick highlights from this fascinating document, his rabbinic contract. So if you look in the source that I've put up here on the shared screen, so first of all, how often do you give a drasha? In letter bet, it says Gam Yishmor Moreinu VeRabbeinu VeAdoneinu Shtei Shabbatot BaShana. So you're going to publicly preach two Shabbos a year, right? It's a plum gig. I'm just joking, because this was actually quite typical in this period. As I think I may have mentioned in one of the earlier classes, it was typical for a community to hire an itinerant preacher or a magid to give the weekly drasha, but the special drashas, that's given, that's reserved for the chief rabbi. So what are they? Shabbos Shuvah, Shabbos Agadol. Those are the main drashas. Number four is interesting. Dalit, it says Gam Yibarach Hasa'am BeBirkas Hashem BeTzfilas Tal VeGeshem VeGam Tzfilas Ne'ila. So this is somewhat new to me. The rabbi says, you know, there's a chazan. Most communities have some kind of chazan, some kind of bal tzfila. It's not the rabbi, but here in Berlin, the rabbi led the tzfila when for Tzfilas Tal, for Tzfilas Geshem, and Tzfilas Ne'ila. Okay, and the Ne'ila piece is still not entirely uncommon. We don't do it in our shul, but even shuls that have a full-time chazan, it's not uncommon for the rabbi of the shul to lead Ne'ila. Even if he's not a chazan, so they're not looking for chazanos, they're looking for someone who really, you know, who really cares and is really going to daven on behalf of the community. They ask the rabbi to lead to lead Ne'ila. I'll just give you one more fascinating note about this contract, and that is the paycheck. So if you look in Zion, so what do you make? What do you earn if you're the chief rabbi of Berlin in 1730? So we know exactly how much you earned. So the contract says, Midei, second line of Zion, Midei Shavua B'Shavua, Sach Arba Reichstaler. Okay, so 4 Reichstaler a week. It comes out to a little more than 200 Reichstaler a year, which I could just say by comparison is a fraction of what the chief rabbi of Amsterdam was earning, you know, 20 years earlier, but it's something. 200 Reichstaler a year, so it's 4 Reichstaler a week. Uvachodesh Nisan v'Tishrei kaful, okay. But you get a double salary in Nisan and in Tishrei. Why? So there's two reasons, I think. One is that's when you're giving your big drasha, but maybe even more. Like, those are the busy. That's tax season for the rabbi, right? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Tishrei, and Nisan. So everyone's preparing for Pesach, and everyone comes to sell their chametz and ask the questions about how to kosher and so on. The busy season. So fascinating to notice that that's not lost in the community. And at least in Berlin, they were paying the rabbi double during that period of the year. Once again, we don't know really why, but it doesn't last. It's a 4-year contract, and he kind of just maybe makes it to the end of the 4 years. 1734, he takes up a new position in Metz, okay, which again is a very prestigious position. So he's moving up this ladder, recognized as an important figure, but doesn't have the longevity in any particular community. We'll circle back to it in a few minutes, but it's in Metz that the Pnei Yeshua actually publishes the first volume. It's really the second volume, but the first time he publishes a volume of his, what will become a 4-volume work, his Pnei Yeshua, his legendary commentary to Shas. Okay. So let me just say something about what happens next. I want to kind of round out the biography of the Pnei Yeshua, and then I want to talk about the Emden Eibeshitz controversy, and I want to talk about the book that the Pnei Yeshua wrote. Okay, so just to round out the life of the Pnei Yeshua, you can see on the source sheets that I reproduced for you a copy of the Pinchas Kahal of the Frankfurt community. Okay, this is an amazing resource. And let me say, let me just say a word about it, and then I'll put it back up on the screen. So records were very important to European Jews of the period, and there were many kinds of record books. A record book was called a pinkas. So a pinkas was a ledger, and it was handwritten, and there could have been many of them. So there might have been a Pinchas of the Chevra Kedisha, and they might have kept a record of the people in the community who passed away. They might have kept notes from their meetings and so on. The Beis Din kept a Pinchas. So it's a record. Who were the litigants? What was the case? What was the outcome? The time, the date. Then there's a Pinchas Kahal. There's a community book. There's a Kehillah structure, which is often governed by a group of, let's say, 15. It's, every community got its own number, but let's say 15 Parnasim, the 15 officers of the community, and not so different from the way that shuls or other boards function in the 21st century. So there's a board meeting, and you get together, and there's a vote, and you might need to pass a resolution, and there's a new takana about a different tax for the community, or there's some new legislation about an ordinance, certain regulations about how we want people to act in shul or outside of shul, or how many people could be invited to a simcha. And the Pinchas Kahal of Frankfurt survives. We have it. It's a national treasure. It's sitting in the National Library of Israel today. If you're interested, you can make an appointment and you could go see the Pinchas Kahal. Some of it has actually been digitalized. What's amazing, there's so many levels of what's amazing here, is that the book, the same book, right? You could see the same book was in use for over 200 years. Okay? And we have this text. So we know the names and we know the dates of the, you know, the nittiest grittiest of day-to-day life in the Frankfurt Judengasse over the course of this century and beyond. So and again, it's an extraordinary source of information of all kinds. So I'll just give you one excerpt. And again, I think this is really, it's really fascinating. We have the tax records of the Pnei Yeshua. So first of all, it's interesting that he paid any tax at all, because the rabbi, again, not so different from 21st century, like they get a parsonage, there's some special tax break. The community is recognizing that, you know, they're spending most of their time not earning a living. So, you know, how do you make it up to them? So you give them a tax break. So based on the tax records of the Pinchas Kahal of Frankfurt, what's actually clear is that the Pnei Yeshua was quite well to do. So again, this requires more research. There's basically one of two ways that the Pnei Yeshua could have become a wealthy. So these tax records indicate not just, you know, like in a 21st century, you know, US tax return, if you found it as a historical document, so it would tell you how much, you know, Joe Smith earned in 2023. And that would tell you something, but it wouldn't tell you everything. That would just be one year of the person's life. The tax records in the Pinchas tell you both the income and the net worth of the individual. So we have the net worth of the Pnei Yeshua at the end of his life, and it's a big number. And you know it's a big number just in comparison to some of the other community members. So the other community is 300, 500, 800, whatever the, you know, golden, Reichsar, whatever the unit of measure is. And the Pnei Yeshua has 8,000 golden. So, right, he's 20 times, you know, wealthier than the regular people, than the Balabatim. So how did he get so, how did he get so wealthy? So again, I'm just speculating here because we really don't know. We don't know yet. Maybe one day we'll know. But either he married into a wealthy family, right? That's not inconceivable. Or He had a business, right? That's also not inconceivable. Many rabbis to help support themselves in this period had businesses in addition to their rabbinic responsibilities. So again, that's just speculative. I don't know, but what I do know is that by the end of the Bnei Yeshua's life, he has much more money than we would have expected from someone who, again, after being the victim of that explosion in East Jerusalem, like he said, he's starting with nothing. And so he actually did okay for himself over the course of his lifetime. So let me just say two last words about the Bnei Yeshua's biography, and then I want to get to the Emden Eibeshitz controversy and to the book of the Bnei Yeshua itself. So the two last things I want to say about the Bnei Yeshua, he becomes the chief rabbi of Frankfurt after leaving his post in Metz in 1741, and he serves as chief rabbi of Frankfurt basically for 10 years, and then there's some ambiguity the last 5 years of his life. He dies in 1756, so he's in and around Frankfurt, in Mannheim, and in Worms, and in Offenbach, and sometimes back to Frankfurt. They owe him money. They owe him back pay because things don't end on a happy note for reasons that we won't get into right this second. But he serves for 10 years as the chief rabbi of Frankfurt. And he actually, toward the end of his life, has a plan to make Aliyah. There's a fascinating title that was used in the 18th century. Sometimes someone was designated to be Nasi Eretz Yisrael, or a title like that. What's a Nasi Eretz Yisrael? So it's an honorific. Sometimes it was real, sometimes it was more imagined, but the Nasi Eretz Yisrael was responsible for collecting money being kind of a figurehead for the Jews of Palestine. Again, it's a small community. It's a community that's struggling financially always. So there's a Nasi Eretz Yisrael, someone who could be, again, a kind of figurehead to collect money and represent the Jews of Israel. So the Bnei Yeshua was appointed or selected to be the Nasi Eretz Yisrael, and he actually had a plan to travel and to, you know, quote unquote, retire to Eretz Yisrael. But he writes that he became too infirm, and it never happened. And he ended up passing away before he could ever reach the land of Israel. And he's buried in Frankfurt in 1756. The Bnei Yeshua requested that he not be eulogized. Bnei Yeshua requested that he not be eulogized. That just wasn't who he was. It wasn't his. It wasn't his personality. But the gedolim of the time set aside his wishes. It's a question in the halacha. What do you do if someone passes away and they told you before they died, or they left in their last will and testament, no eulogies? Do you listen to them or you don't listen to them? So the halacha is you really do listen to them. We consider principally the hesped to be something for the benefit of the deceased. And if the deceased says, you know, before they die, I'm not interested in that. So generally we do heed the wishes of someone who says, no eulogies for me. But you could see in source number 8, I'll just summarize in the interest of time, the Nodi Bihuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau, who was, you know, the next Gadol Hador, said, I know the Bnei Yeshua said no eulogies, but I'm overriding him. I'm overriding him because when someone is the Gadol Hador, you don't listen. And the Gadol Hador always has to be eulogized. The Bnei Yeshua was the Gadol Hador, and I'm delivering a eulogy for the Bnei Yeshua. Okay. So now I want to circle back to the Emden Eibeshitz controversy, unless there are any questions before I move forward. Okay, so I know Rabbi Schachter was the rabbi of the Jewish Center for 19 years, and some of you who may have been members of the Jewish Center over the course of the time period when Rabbi Schachter was the rabbi, surely heard his world-renowned talks on the Emden Eibischitz controversy. Much of what I know about the Emden Eibischitz controversy, I learned from Rabbi Schachter and his writings, and from the writings and the classes of Professor Schneer Lyman. Schneer Lyman always says Rabbi Schachter is the world expert on Rabbi Yaakov Emden, and Rabbi Schachter says Professor Lyman is the world expert. So they duke it out. I feel privileged to have studied with both of them. And what I want to share with you is a very kind of brief, you know, exposure to this controversy. I once took a 15-week seminar with Professor Lyman. It was just on the controversy. We just scratched the surface in the course of an entire semester. So 10 minutes, right, is to scratch the surface of the surface. Rest assured, it was arguably one of, if not the most significant rabbinic controversies in the history of the Jewish people. Professor Lyman likes to joke, by the end of the controversy, if you are, were a rabbi and you weren't in cherem, you're a nobody, because anybody who was a somebody was put in cherem by one of the two sides of the controversy. It engulfed the entirety of the Jewish world. What was this about, and why are we talking about this? So we're talking about it because Rabbi Yaakov Yehoshua Falk was really the rainmaker of the controversy. We call it the Emden Eibischitz controversy. But as we'll talk about in a minute, or as you may already know, Rav Yaakov Emden, who precipitated the controversy, was not in a position of influence the way that that the Bnei Yehoshua was. Rav Yaakov Emden really didn't hold a public public position, and he was so zealous in his opposition of Rav Yonason Eibischitz that it detracted from or diminished the his capacity to actually hold sway and move people. So he moved people by writing letters and broadsides and agitating, but the public figure around whom the opponents of Rabbi Yonason Eibischitz rallied was his chief opponent, right, on the Emden side, was the Bnei Yehoshua. Okay, so very, very briefly, just to sketch out what it is that that we're talking about. On February 4th, 1751, Rabbi Yaakov Emden announced, he was living in Altona, the triple community of Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. And he's just a private citizen. He's not the chief rabbi of the city. His father had been the chief rabbi. He probably wanted to be the chief rabbi, but he was a private citizen, Talmud Chacham, someone who had published a lot of svarim. But in 1751, he announced in a private minyan in his home that an amulet ascribed to Rav Yonason Eibischitz was actually Sabadian in nature. So what's an amulet? What's a kamiya? So again, we're a little prepared for this because we've talked about the Kabbalistic, you know, nature of rabbinic Judaism in the first half of the 18th century in Frankfurt and beyond. So we've seen a little of this before, and it shouldn't surprise us to learn that very traditional Ashkenazic rabbis in Germany, German-speaking lands, Yiddish-speaking lands, and beyond, were writing amulets. So, what's an amulet? An amulet is a kind of charm, a code, some kind of, you know, small document that could be tucked away by someone who needs a bracha, someone who needs protection. The ones that we're talking about are typically amulets for women who are trying to make sure that they have a safe childbirth. Okay, childbirth in the 18th century is a very dangerous thing. Not everyone survives childbirth, and it's scary. And if you could get an amulet from a big rabbi that says that you should be blessed and you're going to be okay, so that could give you a lot of comfort. And the name of the person who writes these amulets is a Baal Shem. Okay, so the Baal Shem Tov is the most famous Baal Shem. Rabbi Yonason Eibischitz was also a Baal Shem, and was not uncommon, in addition to the prodigious, you know, learning that he did that we would consider traditional with, you know, Gemara and Rashi and Tosfos and the Shulchan Aruch. So he also would sometimes write kamios. He would write amulets. Rabbi Yaakov Emden announced one day that it happens to be that some amulets written by Rabbi Yonason Eibischitz Bjornason Eibeschütz is the chief rabbi of Altona Hamburg-Wandsbek and is widely respected and renowned as a massive Talmud Chacham. He has a yeshiva. He has many students. So Yaakov Emden announces that he happens to be the chief rabbi of one of the most prominent and prestigious communities in all of the Jewish world. It just happens to be that he's a Sabbatian, that he's a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. And remember, Shabtai Tzvi has been dead since 1676. He apostatized, you know, 9 years before he died. This is an old story. Nobody living in 1751 would have even, right, remembered, you know, in a first-person way, Shabtai Tzvi, right? This is like generations later. But this notion of Sabbatianism, as we've talked about, persists. And underground, beneath the surface, we're not talking about it, but it's a thing. People believe in Shabtai Tzvi. So Rav Yonason Eibeschütz had already earned a reputation as a renowned scholar. He had been in Prague and in Metz. He had come to Altona Hamburg-Wandsbek the year before in 1750. He had once been accused 25 years earlier of being a Sabbatian. And he signed on to a document that said, "I hereby banish and abolish, right, all Sabbatians. We're anti-Sabbatian," right? So he survived that little mini scandal 25 years earlier, but now it's up again. And Rav Yaakov Emden is shouting from the rooftops, "Listen to me, citizens of Altona Hamburg-Wandsbek, your chief rabbi is a Sabbatian." Okay. Now, the community was not too happy about this, and they placed Rav Yaakov Emden basically under house arrest and said, "You have to stop this. We're not listening to your agitation, and we're not getting involved. Thank you for your concern. We like Rav Yonason Eibeschütz. He's our chief rabbi. We're sticking by him. We're standing with him. And if you found some, you know, hidden code that you Kabbalists are interested, we're not interested." But before he was placed under house arrest, Rav Yaakov Emden managed to send a series of letters to all of his colleagues, the leading rabbis of the generation, including to the Pnei Yeshua in front. So as Professor Lyman explains, there were really, you know, three approaches to dealing with Rav Yonason Eibeschütz and this accusation that he was, in fact, a closet Sabbatian. So approach number one was Rav Yaakov Emden, which is just a full-on frontal assault. Okay, it's not a strategy session here. It's just we're on the attack because this guy's a heretic, and whatever we need to do, let's just do it because that's what we need to do. Approach number two, okay, was the approach of Rabbi Cheska Landa, who I just mentioned a minute ago, who ended up eulogizing the Pnei Yeshua. Bicheska Landau, who's in Prague, says we need some kind of moderation, and what we can do is, you know, use the similar tactic as has been used in the past. We'll ask everyone to sign a general ban against Sabbatianism. Okay, and this way, Rabbi Yonason Eibeschütz has a graceful exit. All he has to do is sign on to the ban. And as long as he does that, you know, we can put the accusations to rest, and we'll know that he's kind of on our side, and we can put the whole thing to bed, and we can move forward. Okay. The third approach was the approach of the Pnei Yeshua, who Professor Lyman calls the chief strategist of the Emden Eibeschütz affair. For 5 years, right, from 1751 until 1756, until he died. His goal was to, the Pnei Yeshua's goal was to have Rabbi Yonason Eibeschütz appear before a Beis Din. And the idea was that a Beis Din of leading rabbis would interrogate Rabbi Yonason Eibeschütz, and they would issue a verdict. And if they found that he was guilty, he would be defrocked, he'd be deposed, he would lose his rabbinic position. And if not, if he's really innocent or he's guilty but wants to do tshuva, so he could be rehabilitated, and he could do whatever he needs to do to be rehabilitated and to regain his standing in the community. And again, this was an old tactic from a playbook of the 1720s, and we saw it a little right with the Ramchal. You stand before a Beis Din and you could take an oath and you could take a shvua and you disavow, and you could find a way to move forward even if you've been accused of nothing less than heresy. So the Bnei Yeshua made an overture and wrote a letter to Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz and said, why don't we do this? You can come before a Beis Din, we'll sort it all out, you could do tshuva, and there's a way out of this. And he wrote him another letter. And he wrote him another letter, and there's no response. And finally, the Pnei Yeshua says to Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz, I have no choice. You haven't responded to any of my letters. It's now incumbent upon me to go public and to declare in no uncertain terms that you are in fact guilty of heresy. And I have it for you, and I'm sorry we don't have enough time to go through it, but when you have time, it's in the source sheet. This is an excerpt from Professor Lyman's article, When a Rabbi is Accused of Heresy, in source number 7. And you have the whole, he translated the whole letter that the Pnei Yeshua wrote as a broadside, as like what we'd call today an open letter, a public letter for the whole community to know about, accusing Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz of heresy. Okay? And basically saying, you know, if you don't repent, you are in cherem, and no one can have anything to do with you, and no one can have anything to do with any of your books and any of your writings. And over the course of this controversy, right, as I mentioned at the beginning, so everyone ends up in cherem. There's the Emden camp and there's the Eibeshitz camp, and each one thinks that the other is totally wrong. Except that the Gidolei Hador, led by none other than the Pnei Yeshua, were totally, totally convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz was guilty of nothing less than heresy in the form of Sabbateanism. And we have the amulets. We have the transcripts of the amulets, and they're coded, but if you decode them, they're plain for all to see. There's been no shortage of literature on this controversy, and I'll just tell you off the record that Professor Lyman has a new article coming out on a little-known text of the Pnei Yeshua broadside that that no one had ever seen before. That article will be published, please God, over the summer, and we'll have even more information about the Pnei Yeshua's indispensable role in this controversy. How did it end? It ended badly, right? There was no winner. In 1753, Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz had his case heard before the Council of the Four Lands, the Vad Arba Aratzot. He was vindicated by not a majority, but at least a plurality. He, in 1756, he was reelected as the chief rabbi of Altena Hamburg-Wandsbek. So he continued to function in a very public role and a very public position. 1764, when Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz died in Altena Hamburg-Wandsbek, he was eulogized and honored. But at the same time, right, the cat was out of the bag, the jig was up, and he was isolated. Everyone, you know, had pointed their fingers. Everyone had taken sides. His students, the number of students, certainly diminished over the course of time, and you know, everyone, in a certain way, everyone lost in the course of this controversy. There's much more to say, but that's a snapshot of the political role that the Pnei Yeshua played in really, I think, arguably the most important rabbinic controversy of the 18th century, and maybe of the last 300 years. Before we run out of time, let me say two words about the Pnei Yeshua the book that the Rabbi Yaakov Yehoshua Falk left to us and left to posterity. The Pnei Yehoshua is a commentary on the Talmud, and according to Professor Tashma, and no one has really, with the one possible exception, no one has really dared to argue with him. But Professor Tashma claimed a number of years ago that the Pnei Yehoshua really represented a watershed mark in the history of Jewish literature and revolutionized the way that that rabbis wrote commentaries to the Talmud forevermore. It was an inflection point. It was a turning point. The old world had focused on pilpul and abstractions and abstract ideas, and the Pnei Yehoshua just changed the world of Talmud learning. And I'll just say two words about how he did it. So first of all, he privileged the question over the answer. And he just asked like these bomb questions that either people had been afraid to ask or unable to ask. And once you see that, it's like a jaw-dropping, right, mic-dropping kind of questions, like, well, now what do we do? Right. And, he introduced this kind of license to ask this kind of question. I have for you in source number 12 an example of this question. I'll just say it in a 30 second version. So it's my Hanukkah, and again, this is not a halachic book, even though it's a halachically oriented book, and that's very important. It's a commentary to the Talmud. And so the Talmud is writing about the Hanukkah miracle and the story of the Chashmonaim and the oil, and there wasn't any oil, and they only found this one jug. And the Pnei Yehoshua says, just one second, okay, just stop the presses for one second. I just want to understand, I'll just give this one, he says, V'lichar yesh litmoa kol tarei hanese, lama, tahakaimel antuma hutra betzibon, v'hayacholim lahadlik b'shem en tameh. He says, it's just like everyone forgot a basic premise of Talmudic reasoning, which is to know that tuma hutra betzibur, that sometimes you have something is tame and sometimes something is tahor. And we all know, we learned in school, there was no oil that was tahor, so it couldn't be lit in the base. And the Pnei Yehoshua says, it's an exigent circumstance. And in an exigent circumstance, we allow tuma for the community, it didn't matter if the oil is tummy. Like, the prohibition is suspended in such a circumstance. So there's a whole miracle of how they lasted, and you didn't need a miracle. You can light with the oil that's tummy. Okay, which is like, oh my gosh, that's a fall off your chair. Wait, the whole two pages of Gemara are predicated on the fact. He's like, no, that's actually not true. Okay, so you have to work out the answers, but much less significant than the answers for the Pnei Yehoshua are these questions, which again have the capacity to kind of blow things out of the water and give us an entirely new perspective on the Talmud and everything that we thought we knew. He also, as I mentioned, provided this kind of rich alternative to the approach of Pilpul. The learning wasn't theoretical anymore. It was actually directed at something very practical, right? The halacha and the sense that, right, this is all, why are we learning this, right? So the Talmud and the logic and the machlokas and the back and the forth. No, but this is all oriented toward a goal of figuring out, right, what the halacha, it's not the first person to conceive of Talmud this way, of course, right? But his commentary is predicated on this assumption, and it changes the tenor of everything that follows. He was the first among his contemporaries to make wide use of the Yerushalmi in his method. He writes at the beginning, he's always interested in answering Rashi's Tosos's question on Rashi. He elevates the status of the other Rishonim, especially the Sephardic Rishonim, the Ramban and the Rush, the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva, some of which were newly published in the 18th century. So again, just to give you a snippet and a snapshot for what it is that B'nai Yeshua contributed to the life of Talmudic commentary forevermore. We're just about out of time, but I'll just say one final word, and that is that the B'nai Yeshua has this kind of larger than life reception, right? And he's quoted left and right by the commentaries and by the poskim since the publication of the first volume of his work in 1739. Whether and to what extent the B'nai Yeshua revolutionized Talmud learning is something of an open question, but he gave us amazing questions and he gave us license to ask even the most irreverent questions. But maybe it was that same ability to question that gave him license to question, right, Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz in that controversy, a controversy the reverberations of which would be felt for hundreds of years to come. Let me pause here. I'm going to break for 30 seconds, and then I'm happy to open it up for questions and comments.